This episode was originally recorded on May 1st, 2024. As of last Monday, Captain Paul Watson was arrested in Greenland for anti-whaling activity with the threat of extradition to Japan. To learn more, please visit paulwatsonfoundation.org/freepaulwatson.
Welcome to Pause and Reflect, the podcast where compassion meets action and where we dive deep into the stories of those who advocate for the voiceless, nurture our planet, and foster a more compassionate world. I'm your host, Alexander Taylor Clayton, here to explore the intersections of animal welfare, environmental sustainability, and the innovative solutions shaping our future. So sit back, stay curious, and join us as we reflect on the change we wish to see in the world. Let's embark on this journey together.
Welcome to Pause and Reflect, where we delve into the pressing issues at the intersection of animal welfare and environmental conservation. I'm your host, Alexander Taylor Clayton, and today we have a truly, truly special episode for you. Joining us is a figure synonymous with marine conservation and direct action on the high seas, Captain Paul Watson, co-founder of Greenpeace, founder of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and now the leader of the Captain Paul Watson Foundation, has been a formidable force in the fight against illegal whaling and fishing, dedicating his life to defending oceanic wildlife and preserving our planet's marine biodiversity. Captain Paul Watson, it is an absolute pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you.
You're currently in France right now, right? Is that correct?
Yes, in Paris. I live in Paris.
Are you? Kind of looks like you're in a boat right now.
Yeah, I live on a boat on the Seine River in the middle of Paris.
Oh, lovely, lovely. Captain Paul Watson, thank you so much for joining us here today. I know you're a very busy individual with so much going on. Could you tell us a little bit about the work that you do and the route that your life has taken? What got you into marine conservation?
Well, I was raised in a fishing village on the east coast of Canada. So ever since I was 10 years old, I've been involved with protecting marine wildlife. And then I was the youngest founding member of Greenpeace in 1972. And I founded the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in 1977. And then I established the Captain Paul Watson Foundation in 2022.
Quite a legacy. Everybody in the field of conservation is very highly aware of Greenpeace, of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and now your new foundation. That is quite a record and a legacy of direct action that you've had. I'm sure you must be very proud.
Well, I guess so. But what I'm happiest with is that we've accomplished so much over the years. You know, we shut down whaling in the Southern Ocean and have saved literally tens of thousands of whales, seals, dolphins, and that over the years.
Excellent work. Can you tell us about the transition from Sea Shepherd to starting the Captain Paul Watson Foundation? What motivated this significant change?
I think, well, Sea Shepherd became too successful. A lot of it had to do with our Whale Wars TV show, which brought in a lot of support and therefore brought in a lot of money. And that brought in people who had ulterior motives. And in 2022, I was maneuvered over about a two-year period. I was maneuvered off the board of directors and suddenly found myself in a minority situation where then I was told that I was too controversial and too confrontational. And basically, they told me they didn't want me to lead any campaigns, write anything, post anything, or give any talks, but they would pay me to be a figurehead, which I refused to do.
They were telling you were bad for business, is what I'm hearing.
So I decided, well, you know, I'm not going to be paid to be a figurehead for something that I created. So I left and set up the Captain Paul Watson Foundation. And I named it that way because, you know, it's going to be more difficult for somebody to take over something that has my actual name in it. But really what we're doing is carrying on with exactly what we've been doing for the last almost 50 years, which is true to the strategy that I developed in 1977, which I call aggressive nonviolence. That is to aggressively intervene, but without causing any harm. And we've never caused a single injury to anybody in our entire history. But the people who took over chose to abandon that strategy. They've chosen to go mainstream, I guess, and forget that the reason that we became so successful and so well-known was because of our sort of a controversial and confrontational tactic.
Well, it's because you would push the envelope. You would go that extra mile that so many were not willing to do, and it was vital. It was necessary. It because that's how evil gets away in this world. Nobody stands up to it.
So they seized all the assets and the ships and the supporting list. So it put me at a real disadvantage, but it's taken me 2 years to recover. And now we have three vessels, and we're going against the Icelandic whaling fleet this summer. I'm going to head off the possible return to the Japanese whaling fleet to the Southern Ocean at the end of this year. So got a lot to do. And finally, I'm in a position where we have the means to actually to do that.
Incredible. What are the core missions of the Captain Paul Watson Foundation? I assume they're very similar to previous initiatives, but in your own words, please, what would be the core missions and how do they align or differ from your previous work? You touched on it a little bit.
Well, we remain the same, the protection, defense of diversity and interdependence of marine life in the ocean, opposition to illegal exploitation, pirate whaling, illegal fishing, that kind of thing. There's actually no change at all from my point of view. The change was with the people who forced me out of the organization. They're no longer utilizing aggressive nonviolence, and they're not directly intervening. They're not blockading. It's mainly more about taking pictures and PR, really. So, you know, they wanted to get job security for the positions that I actually put them in. You know, these are people I've known for 10, 20 years. And so I guess that they felt that I was a threat to their job security.
That's unfortunate. I can understand to a degree, capitalism makes us all complicit to a certain degree when you're trying to worry about your livelihood. But when it comes to things like marine conservation and whaling and everything that's going on, dolphin hunting in the seas off the coast of Japan, there is a higher calling. And I appreciate you sticking to that. It says a lot about your character.
Well, the one good thing about it is that it certainly motivated me, inspired me all over again, you know. Even if you have to start from the grassroots up again, you know, that gives a lot of, a lot of inspiration. So I think that we're, you know, been rejuvenated in that respect. And so we're going back into the campaigns with that kind of renewed enthusiasm. Like I said, they took everything away from me except for the three things that matter most. And that is the courage, the imagination, and the passion of the crew. And a lot of my crew now are people who have been with me for many, many years. So that's remained constant.
And speaking of campaigns, you mentioned that off camera that there's two campaigns coming up that you wanted to promote that seem incredibly exciting. There are Operation Ice Storm and Operation Bloody Fjords. Could you elaborate on Operation Ice Storm and what specific strategies are you planning to implement with this?
Just less than 2 months in June, we'll be going to Iceland, to the waters of Iceland, to block and stop the two Icelandic whaling ships that are operating there. The majority of people in Iceland are opposed to whaling, but it continues because of one man, Christian Lofsson. He doesn't do it for the money. He loses $1 to $2 million a year killing whales, but he likes doing it. It's sort of his hobby, and he's the richest and most influential man in Iceland.
Wow.
He's good. He's usually gets what he wants. And so we're going to make sure this summer he doesn't get what he wants.
One of those types. Okay.
You know, it'll probably be quite a confrontational campaign, but our objective is to make sure he doesn't kill any whales. The other one is at the same time, through the Captain Paul Watson Foundation in the UK, we'll be landing crew in the Faroe Islands to intervene against the killing of pilot whales and dolphins. And there the objective is to get in the way of what they're doing. And I'm sure people will be arrested. But, you know, we've been there before.
That's Operation Bloody Fjords, correct?
Yeah. And if we have to fill their jails in order to get the attention of the world, then I guess that's what we'll have to do. What they're doing in the Faroe Islands is also illegal. You know, under European Union law, you can't kill whales and dolphins. And the Faroes argue that they're exempt from European law because they're a territory of Denmark. Although they enjoy all the benefits of being the members of the EU, they have EU passports, which allows them to work in the European Union. So they take all the advantages of it, but then they say we don't have to abide by the law. So we have to keep rocking the boat and making waves here and get the European Parliament to understand that they should not be exempt under European Union regulations.
No, nobody should have special status like that. No, that's an abuse. With these campaigns, what are the biggest challenges that these campaigns face? How does your foundation address them? Like you mentioned before, like imprisonment is a very serious possibility at times.
Well, we operate within the boundaries of the law. Most of the people that we're opposing are operating illegally. The biggest challenge is always fundraising. You know, ships are expensive, so that's our biggest challenge. Actual implementing the strategies, the blocking, the interventions, that's pretty much the easy part. I've been doing that for 50 years. I don't find that very challenging. The challenging part, again, you know, is especially when you've had to start all over again, is raising the funds to do that, recruiting, you know, supporters worldwide.
Now, let's talk about tactical and strategic approaches. How does the Captain Paul Watson Foundation approach the planning and execution of such an expansive marine conservation campaign, such as Operation Ice Storm or Bloody Fjords? What goes into that?
When you look at the campaign, what are they doing? How are they doing it? And then how can you intervene? How can you block and intercept? And that's what we do. Down in the Southern Ocean over the years, you know, we were able to intervene by blocking their ability to kill whales, by blocking their ability to refuel their vessels. And that became more successful every year. So in the 2012-2013 season, for example, they only took 10% of their quota. So overall, we saved about 6,500 whales through that direct physical intervention. Also, bringing it to the attention to the world, I mean, that this is illegal. Finally, they were taken to the International Court of Justice in 2014, which ruled against Japan. And that stopped them for a year, but then they started up again. I just completely ignored the International Court of Justice because it has no enforcement body.
And if I'm correct, Japan actually left the accords at one point.
They left the International Whaling Commission.
That's what I was thinking of.
And that was in 2019. And then they said that they're no longer going to return to the Southern Ocean, that their whaling would be coastal whaling. But just this year, they completed the construction of $150 million new factory ship to replace the aging Nishan Maru. And the only point of having a factory ship with that kind of range is to go back to the Southern Ocean. So we're fully expecting them to return, and we want to be in a position to intercept them when they do.
Could you describe a particularly successful or maybe a challenging moment in one of your recent campaigns? Something that really sticks out in your mind as a highlight?
Last summer, when we arrived in Icelandic waters, on the very day that we arrived, the Icelandic government put a temporary moratorium on the killing of whales. So there was no whales killed last summer until the end of September. We weren't able to return because our interventions in the Faroe Islands caused Denmark to put pressure on Jamaica to remove the flag. We had the Jamaican flag, and it took us about 2 months to reflag the vessel. In the meantime, they killed 24 whales, but we've reflagged and we're in a position to once again intervene. I think our most successful campaigns over the years from between 2005-2015 was the shutting down of Japanese illegal whaling operations in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary.
Amazing. Now, I'm very curious about, does the foundation collaborate with other conservation groups or government or international bodies? I imagine there would have to be quite a few partnerships or collaboration involved with some of these campaigns. Is there anything like that?
Well, we work in partnership with Sea Shepherd France and Sea Shepherd Brazil. Both those entities remain loyal to the original objectives of Sea Shepherd. And Sea Shepherd United Kingdom changed its name to the Captain Paul Watson Foundation, as did Sea Shepherd Uruguay. So, you know, we're still working with a lot of the people that we worked with before. It was the Sea Shepherd Global people. They're actually suing us, but recently we won the court case. Sea Shepherd Global sued me and said that I had no right to the name that I created or the logos that I designed, but they lost that case, so that we're pursuing that even further. But it's a waste of time and energy and everything, but this, you know, that's their mindset, is to try and take complete control. Because I set up Sea Shepherd to be a movement, not an organization to be controlled by any one group of people or any one person. And maybe that was my mistake, because by setting it up that way, I didn't have control over it. And I trusted that these people would not do such a thing, but they did.
Well, exactly. You had trust in these people, and you had a mission that you wanted to go out and do. You had something you believed in, and that was the focus.
Yes, and since then, they've also done a lot of things which greatly disturbed me, like Sea Shepherd Australia is in partnership with the Austral Fishing Company, which is owned by the Marua Daichiro Fishing Company of Japan, the largest fishing company in the world. And so from our policy of not supporting so-called sustainable fishing, they're now supporting sustainable fishing. And when I questioned that, I was dismissed from the board of directors of the Sea Shepherd Australia. The other thing that's very disturbing is that they have a partnership with Yamasec, which is an Israeli security firm. So they have IDF soldiers on board their vessels now, supposedly for security, but they're paying a great deal of money to have them on board. And two of those soldiers, one the official representative for Sea Shepherd Israel, not only is an IDF soldier, but he was openly bragging about advocating genocide on his Facebook pages, which has now been removed. And
that's also very alarming.
And also their campaign leader on one of the, on the Mexican campaign had to take a leave from his duties with on the ship to go back to Israel to rejoin the IDF. So I just found that very, you know, we're not supposed to be involved with those kind of political activities, and certainly not to such an egregious thing as being involved with genocide.
No, that's very alarming indeed. Between the Japanese corporation and this, it's almost a little conspiratorial of what might be going on behind the scenes. Like, what are they getting up to?
Well, one of the reasons they wanted me out of there is because of their alliances. For instance, they got a partnership with the Allianz Insurance Company, with Lloyd's of London. So they're receiving money from these organizations, and they got partnerships with some very corrupt African governments in Liberia and Namibia. And for instance, their ships get free berthage now in Namibia, and just 100 miles from where those berthage is taking place is the second largest slaughter of seals on the planet. And yet they don't say a word about it. They don't intervene because they don't want to offend the Namibian government. So when I was with Sea Shepherd, I was complaining about that. I said, look, you know, these partnerships you're getting into, the governments are telling us what to do. You know, for instance, you can't have the camel colors on the ship anymore. They have to be painted a drab gray. You can't use our Jolly Roger flag. You can't put out any press releases unless they're approved by the government's partners. I said, this is not what we're all about.
But that's too much control.
But I was outvoted and basically removed from the organization that I had established. But on the positive side, we're now back in control of what we're doing. And so we'll continue to do what we have been doing, and this time without that kind of collusion and compromising.
And going back to the issue of collaboration, I'm curious about local community. Do local communities play a role in your conservation efforts? For example, Iceland or the Faroe Islands, are there any local communities who maybe are in favor that you maybe get to work with to try to stop this issue?
Well, we have the foundation is now in about 17 different countries, and we have people in Iceland, we have people in the Faroe Islands, and yeah, we're working with them. Anytime a grind, which is a slaughter of dolphins, takes place in the Faroe Islands, we have Faroese people who are there to document that and to forward that information to us. We also have people on the ground in Iceland doing the same thing, so we always know what's going on. It's good to have ground support in these countries, which we have.
How do you measure the success of your conservation efforts? Are there any specific indicators that you look at that says we are doing very well right now? Is there anything like that that you have to measure the mark?
Well, when we first began our opposition to the killing of whales, it was in numerous countries. And since then, we've stopped whaling in, well, let me see, in Australia, Spain, Chile, Peru, South Korea. We shut down pirate whaling operations in the Atlantic. We also stopped them in South Africa. In sealing, you know, they were killing hundreds of thousands of baby harp seals off the east coast of Canada. We got the white coat thing banned, and then we were able to get the market undermined in Europe, which cut down their quota, which is still, by the way, the quota of the Canadian seal hunt is 450,000 a year. But they're not killing that many because there's no market. We've taken that market away from them. So the kill quota now is about 40,000, and we're still working on that. The problem is that there's so much incentive to exploit life in the ocean that we're up against an incredible opposition, which is making immense profits. So it's not just whaling and sealing. It's also overfishing. It's ocean mining. It's plastic pollution. There's so many things that are threatening life and diversity in the sea. I'm concerned that, you know, as I always say, if the ocean dies, we all die. And the ocean is in serious danger. Since 1950, there's been a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton in the sea. 40% diminishment. What that means is that phytoplankton provides up to 70% of the oxygen in the air we breathe. If we lose phytoplankton, we lose life on this planet. It's as simple as that. Phytoplankton is the foundation for life on this planet. And yet most people aren't even aware of it. It's also the foundation for the food pyramid in the ocean, too. The phytoplankton feeds the krill feeds the whales and the seals and everything else. And why is this happening? It's because we've diminished the number of whales and dolphins and seabirds and fishes. And those species provide the nutrient base for the phytoplankton, the magnesium, the iron, and the nitrogen. And this provided primarily in their feces. Whales are really the farmers of the ocean, and they're fertilizing these crops of phytoplankton, which keeps the entire ocean healthy. that's really illustrating the law of interdependence within a diversity, within an ecosystem. There are three laws of ecology, right, mainly. There's the law of diversity, that the strength of an ecosystem is dependent upon diversity within it. The second is the law of interdependence, that all species within an ecosystem are interdependent with each other. And the third is the law of finite resources, that there's a limit to growth because there's a limit to carrying capacity. And when you diminish that carrying capacity, you cause diminishment of diversity and interdependence. So that leads to ecological collapse. So it's a very serious issue. But again, most people aren't really aware of it, nor do they care. And the reason for that is that our entire civilization point of view is anthropocentric. It's all about us.
You know? Oh, I need to have like a little buzzer. A guest said one of my favorite buzzwords from my show here. As an environmental anthropologist, one of my biggest points is talking about anthropocentrism and combating anthropocentric views. I love that you mentioned that. And also, what a beautiful way to explain the entire issue. That was phenomenal. Thank you so much for that.
Well, in 2020, I actually established the Church of Biocentrism to try and get this point across. And, you know, because we forget that our very existence on this planet is dependent upon all these other species. I had a reporter from Fox News a few years ago call me up and he said, did you say that birds, trees, worms, and bees were more important than people? And I said, yeah, I said that. And he said, how could you say something so outrageous, so unchristian? I said, well, because they're more important than people for the simple fact that they can live here without us, but we can't live here without them. We need them. They don't need us. So if we're going to survive on this planet, we have to live in harmony with all of these other species. And we have to understand that we're not the most important species on the planet, and that we have to be part of everything and not lord and dominant over everything else.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I could not agree more.
The other way I like to express this is to tell people that, you know, just picture the Earth as a spaceship, which is what it is. We're on this incredible voyage around the Milky Way. And every spaceship has a life support system, and that provides us with the food we eat and regulates climate and temperature, provides us with the air we breathe. And that life support system is maintained, regulated, maintained, and serviced by a crew of engineers, and not us. We humans, we're passengers. We're having a wonderful time amusing ourselves on spaceship Earth. But what we're doing is we're killing, we're murdering off the engineers. We're killing them each every day. And there's only so many engineers you can kill off before the machinery begins to fall apart. You know, we don't live in a world without bees and fish and trees and whales, and that we simply don't. So, you know, it's important that people come to realize that. And if we don't, then our, you know, survival is very much in question.
Well, I wish I had something to add to that, but you wrapped that so succinctly in such a beautiful package. That was incredible.
One of the things I've been doing, you know, is focusing a lot now is writing children's books because I think it's children's.
Oh, you've written children's books? That's incredible.
Last year, my book was We Are the Ocean because children seem to understand this more than adults do. And the idea of We Are the Ocean is one because people don't seem to have any idea what the ocean is. I mean, when you think of the ocean, you think of the sea and surfing or sailing or, you know, swimming. But the ocean is the planet. This is the ocean planet, the planet ocean. It's water. It's water in continuous circulation. And sometimes it's in the sea, and sometimes it's locked in ice, and sometimes it's underground, and sometimes it's in the clouds, and sometimes it's in the cells of every plant and animal on the planet, which means that water is flowing through all of those mediums all the time. So the answer to what is the ocean is we are the ocean. The entire planet is the ocean. So what you do in the sea will impact what is we do in the atmosphere, and what happens there will impact what's on land and what's underground, groundwater pollution, all these kinds of things. Everything is interconnected in that way. And so we should look at it as one thing, this ocean planet.
Of course, one ecosystem. Because it is. Everything is incredibly interconnected. We ourselves are made of 70% water. When you factor in the microbiome inside of us, that we are made up of many living beings, you know, we ourselves are not one individual. We are an individual of an amalgamation of billions of individuals inside of us. It's just a micro to macro levels continuing onwards and outwards from the internal, external. And you're absolutely right. Like this idea that we can live on top of the world and everything serves to function us. One, it's ethically abhorrent, but it's just dense. It's a flagrant lie. It's believing in something very audacious that flies in the face of reality.
Where each and every one of us, we're really walking communities or symbiotic communities of, you know, thousands of different species within us and on us. And but that also holds true with the fact that we're interconnected with all those other species that are everywhere around us. So it's one living organism is the entire planet, really.
Before we dive deeper into today's topic, I want to take a moment to talk about the heart behind our podcast, RALDA, the Romanian League in Defense of Animals. RALDA is more than just an organization. It's a beacon of hope for thousands of animals in need. With a dual mission of rescuing distressed animals in Romania and preventing animal suffering through effective spay and neuter campaigns, RALDA has transformed the lives of animals and communities alike. Our efforts extend beyond rescue and rehabilitation. We're committed to creating sustainable solutions that address the root causes of animal homelessness and neglect. From building modern sanctuaries to provide a safe haven for animals, to education and outreach programs that foster a culture of care and respect, RALDA is on the front lines, making a tangible difference every single day. But this journey isn't one we walk alone. It's the support from people like you, our listeners, who share our passion for animal welfare that empowers RALDA to continue our vital work, whether it's by volunteering, spreading the word, or making a donation. Every action counts towards creating a better world for animals. To learn more about how you can be a part of this transformative mission, visit RALDA.org. If you would like to donate to RALDA and help save a life today, visit RALDA.org/donate. Together, we can make a difference, one animal at a time. Now, let's get back to our story.
Curious, on the topics of direct action and conservation, has your view of these changed or evolved over the years? I imagine being out there and doing all these, having a career in it over so many years, some nuances maybe come into play.
Well, the strength of an ecosystem is in diversity. Therefore, the strength of any movement has to be in diversity. And that approach can be litigation or education or legislation or direct intervention, direct action. It really depends upon the skills and the abilities of each individual, what you're good at, what you can do, what you want to do. But it all comes down to really using your passion, your courage, and your imagination to make the world a better place. And each of us do that in a different way. But if you look throughout all the history of social revolutions, everything that's ever happened has been because of the passion, the imagination, and courage of individuals, from, you know, anti-slavery movement, civil rights movement, the suffragette movement, all of these things. Governments never championed them. Governments opposed them. Governments only supported them after victory was won. For instance, Woodrow Wilson is the man who gets the credit for giving women the right to vote in 1922 in the United States. This man opposed suffragettes at every stage, absolutely opposed them. And then when they finally won, he gets credit for it. That's pretty much what politicians do, is get credit for what individuals do in movements.
And it's hard for me to disagree with that.
And also I found that activists, for instance, they're always reviled. They're always opposed in the present. But when you look back in the past, they were the ones who changed things, whether that be the demonstrations in 1968 against the war, to the demonstrations that are happening right now about Gaza. They can say all the criticisms they want about this, but it always has to be looked in hindsight. No, nothing is ever accomplished in the present that is ever accepted socially at any level. It always has to be appreciated from a point in the future.
That's how the battle of the status quo effectively comes about.
I don't worry about the future because we have no power in the future. We have total power in the present. So what we do in the present will define what the future will be. So I always tell young people, I said, don't get depressed or pessimistic about the future. You have no power over that. But what you can do is do everything utilizing passion, courage, and imagination to change things now. And that will define what the future will be.
I agree with that. I often tell people, you really need to think about it. If you've already decided that this is what the future is going to be, well, then guess what? You are subconsciously creating that future. You've given up hope. Now you are actively helping bring that about. If you want to have a hopeful future, you got to believe it and you got to work in the present now. Exactly. You said it exactly right. I know you said you don't like looking to the future, but with the upcoming projects of Operation Ice Storm and Bloody Fjords, is there any advice you would give to somebody who maybe wants to get involved in marine conservation, or maybe there's some listeners who maybe want to help support these operations coming out? How can people get involved?
Well, people can volunteer to be on our ships or be shore supporters, but really when it comes down to it, everybody needs to find out, what are you passionate about and what skills and abilities do you have to realize that passion? And understand that each and every one of us has the power to make significant changes. Because of Diane Fossey, we still have mountain gorillas in Rwanda. Because of David Wingate, the Bermuda storm petrel did not go extinct. There are so many examples of individuals that have changed things significantly because, first of all, they didn't let anybody tell them they couldn't do it. And second of all, they fervently believed that they could do it. And that's very important that you not be discouraged. That's one of the problems I have with talking with a lot of young people today is they're so easily discouraged. And I keep trying to say, don't pay attention to what the critics say about you. It doesn't really matter. In 1986, we sank half of Iceland's whaling fleet. I just sank two of their ships in Reykjavik Harbor and destroyed their whale processing plant. And at the International Whaling Commission meeting that year, a former colleague came up to me and said, well, what you did in Iceland was despicable, reprehensible. And I said, yeah, well, so what? He said, well, I thought you should be concerned about what people think about you. And I said, no, why? Why should I be? Didn't sink those ships for you or anybody else. We sank them for the whales. But if you can find me a whale that disagreed with what I did, I promise you we won't do it again.
I like that comment.
That might sound like what we did was illegal. You know, sank two ships in Reykjavik Harbor, destroyed a whale processing plant, cost them millions of dollars. But they refused to charge me. I actually flew to Reykjavik in January of 1988 to demand that they arrest me. And instead, they told me to leave the country. And the Minister of Justice said in the parliament, he said, who does he think he is? He comes into our country and demands to be arrested. Get him out of here. Because they knew that to put me on trial would be to put themselves on trial because what they were doing was illegal. So as everybody from Nelson Mandela to Mahatma Gandhi to Martin Luther King always realized is that you got to take these risks. To put society on trial, you have to put yourself in a position to test that. And that often means getting arrested and putting yourself on trial in order to dramatize and illustrate exactly what the crimes of society are.
Of course. I mean, things stay the way they are because of fear. People, you know, are afraid to stand up. And, you know, that's how polities and government bodies or these giant conglomerate corporations or whoever they may be, when you get to a certain scale, that's how they largely stay in power, is because people are afraid to do something. They're afraid to go toe to toe. So when you actually do that and you call them out and you consistently do this, then the world sees for what they really are. And it is incredibly important to do that. I love that.
Well, to be an activist, you know, you're not going to win any popularity contests in the press. And I always say my job is to rock the boat and to make waves and to piss people off. And most importantly, to make them think. And if I've done that, then I've accomplished something. But, you don't do it because you're going to get a medal or you're going to get honors or people are going to like you, that kind of thing.
Now, I know you said that younger generations need to not worry so much about the future, but I'm curious, looking to the future, what are your hopes for the next generation of conservationists? What do you hope for? What do you want to see?
Well, young people really must take action if they're going for their own self-preservation, because things are not looking that good. If the ocean dies, we die. And climate change, all these other factors, nanoplastic in our blood system as well as in the ocean, there are so many problems that have to be addressed. It all really comes down to the fact that our entire socioeconomic systems are run by people whose only concern is profit. And how much material accumulation that they can each accumulate. And so there's very little thought about given to what the future is going to be like. To be a true conservationist, you have to look at what's this world going to be like 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, 1,000,000 years from now. You know, we're losing so many species. We'll lose more species of plants and animals between the year 2000 and the year 2065 than we've lost in the last 65 million years. That rate of extinction is unprecedented. It's going to have a significant impact on the quality of life of all living things on this planet going forward. But unfortunately, in our present socioeconomic system, nobody thinks about beyond the next election or the next five-year fiscal contract or whatever, or the price of the inflation or where things are going.
There's a plague of short-sightedness that runs rampant throughout the global system.
And economics is all down to a short-term investment for short-term gain. There are people literally investing in extinction. I call it the economics and politics of extinction, because diminishment translates into scarcity. Scarcity translates into increased demand. That translates into higher profits. So the more scarce a species is, the more valuable it becomes. The bluefin tuna is now the most expensive fish on the planet because we wiped out 90% of them. The average price of a bluefin tuna in Japan is $75,000 for one fish. And
wow.
And some of them sell for $1 million every year and that. So it's, but why do they not stop killing bluefin tuna? You know, Mitsubishi right now has a 10 to 15 year supply of bluefin tuna in their frozen warehouses. They could stop fishing today and still supply their market if that's what they want to do. But the reason they won't do that is that if they allow the bluefin tuna populations to increase, that's going to diminish.
It won't be as valuable.
Yeah, it's going to diminish the value of the tuna that they have in their warehouses. And if it goes extinct, now what we got in their warehouses is an invaluable commodity. There are actually people who invest in elephant ivory for the sole purpose of investing in extinction, knowing that once the elephant goes extinct, then it'll be a priceless commodity.
What a diabolical thought process.
Yeah, but that's exactly what the kind of anthropocentric perspective has led us to be. You know, what can we get out of it for us now? I had an argument with a Japanese whaling representative one time, and he said, I said, aren't you concerned about the future for your children? And he said, you know, my duty is to provide my family now. People who are born in the future who I don't know, that's their problem. You know. And I was
at least he's honest about it.
I was debating a fisherman in Alaska one time. I said, look, for no other reason, protect the fishery for the benefit of your children who might want to be involved in that industry. And he said, you know, in 5 years my mortgage is paid, and after that, I couldn't give a damn. Why does somebody like that have children? Well, it's what you do. Nobody really gives much thought about it. It's just what you do. And it's interesting. He says he's got to pay off his mortgage. You know, the root of the word mortgage, by the way, is death contract onto death. So we're all too busy paying off our death contracts to actually pay attention to living.
Oh, I could go on a whole rant about capitalism and all that. I could go on forever. How we live in a system that fundamentally just beat you down because they want to make you are their money ticket. The governments kind of live off of their people.
One of the things that, you know, was a revelation over the last 2 weeks is all the university campuses that people are saying you got to divest from your investments in armaments. What the hell is Harvard, Dartmouth, UCLA investing in war for? You know, surely, and they're resisting.
I hadn't heard this. This is interesting.
Yeah, they're saying we need to divest from these investments. It's, you know, I was a national director of the Sierra Club from 2003, 2006. I remember the most emotional argument I got with them is that they wanted to remove the veil of their securities because they weren't allowed to invest in pharmaceuticals and other companies. And some of the directors were arguing that they had a fiduciary responsibility to invest the money for the benefit of the members of the Sierra Club. And I'm saying the members of the Sierra Club joined to protect rainforests and wetlands. They don't give a damn about pharmaceutical investments and everything like that. But their concern was to make you build up the war chest of the Sierra Club. You know, the Sierra Club raised about $85 million a year. And when I was a director, I couldn't account for more than $2 million that was actually spent on projects. And all of this money is going into, you know, all kinds of investments, which are really unethical, in my opinion. But this is the same thing that university campuses are investing in a lot of these things, too. You know, I'm also, it's a revelation, you know, when people say, well, Ireland's no longer going to be supporting sending weapons to Israel, or for instance, or the UK, all these countries are sending all these. Why? When this is all news, I didn't know Ireland was even doing that. I didn't know the UK was doing that. I knew the US was doing it, but, you know.
As a third generation Irish American who tends to pay attention to a lot of Irish politics, I did not even know that. That's new information to me as well.
But at least Ireland is putting an end to that. That's one of the few countries.
Yes, I'm very happy to hear that. I didn't know that they were doing that to begin with, but I'm happy they're putting an end to it. That's great. Wow, this has been an amazing discussion. I've been absolutely thrilled with everything I've been hearing. Final thoughts. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about your work or just about marine conservation in general? Any like final thoughts you would love to part with?
Well, I think going forward in the future, we have to understand that we're not alone on this planet. I think that we're starting to discover now that species communicate with each other. Trees actually communicate with each other through fungal systems and through chemicals. And that.
I was just telling my elementary student just that yesterday.
And whales and dolphins have a language. They communicate with each other. We just don't understand it. A few years ago, a Norwegian whaler was attacking me saying, you know, Watson, you say whales are more intelligent people. How can you say such a stupid thing? And I said, well, you know, George, I measure intelligence by the ability to live in harmony with the natural world. And by that criteria, whales are more intelligent than we are. And he said, well, by that criteria, cockroaches are more intelligent than we are. I said, George, you're beginning to understand what I'm trying to tell you. You know, intelligence. You know, we measure intelligence by eye to hand coordination, the ability to make tools of a blob of protoplasm stepped out of a spaceship with a ray gun. No debate. It's obviously intelligent. It's got technology. We don't understand non-manipulative intelligence, but they're definitely there. And so our bias is because we define what the criteria is for intelligence. But that doesn't mean we're the most intelligent species on the planet. I think we're far from it, really.
No, we're just the one that's propagated the most.
The most important form of intelligence to me is ecological intelligence, the understanding of where we fit in within the biosphere and how we're going to survive within that biosphere and how everything else is going to survive because of us. And that's why I set up the Church of Biocentrism, to get that idea across. You know, a lot of people say, well, you set up a church. It's not really a religion. It's more of a science-based way of looking at things. But
no, not at all. It's absolutely a belief. It's a lifestyle. It's a path of being.
Yeah.
I completely understand that. Would you mind going into a little bit more about biocentrism? I know I said final thoughts, but I'm actually glad you brought up, because I think it's such an important concept that my listeners would really latch on to.
Well, indigenous cultures around the world understand what biocentrism is, you know, their relationship with the natural world. But, you know, for thousands of years, human societies have so alienated themselves from the natural world by putting ourselves at front and center, even to the point of inventing gods in our image to explain reality, instead of accepting the fact that evolution has put us in the position where we are right now. And we're only here by virtue of the fact that all of these other species make it possible for us to actually be here. And people forget, because we have this incredible ability to adapt to diminishment. As things become diminished, we just accept it. You know, the very idea in 1965 that we'd be drinking water out of plastic bottles and paying more for that water than the equivalent amount of gasoline was unthinkable. But here we are on that doing that. In 1970s, you know, every 100 miles you're driving down your car, you had to stop at a gas station and have your windows washed from all the dead insects that were on the window. That doesn't happen anymore. But people,
that was an image back in like old films that they would do image. That's not something you see anymore,
yeah, because
you don't experience it.
We so diminish the amount of insects in the world, and a world without insects is not a healthy world.
No.
And we're polluting the soil with herbicides, fungicides, pesticides, so many different kinds of poisons, bactericides, all of these things. And that's creating a world which is going to be unsustainable. And of course, it all really, you know, there's too many of us and not enough resources to support what we're doing.
Not the way we're running things anyway. The
amazing thing is that we're quite willing to spend hundreds of million dollars to resurrect the woolly mammoth or the woolly rhinoceros and to clone these animals and everything, but we're not willing to prevent other species from going, like the vaquita, from going completely extinct.
As someone who's a millennial who has grown up with these fanciful ideas of what the future would look like, as much as I would love the idea of a woolly mammoth coming back or these ancient species, yeah, let's bring back some of the more recent ones that we've killed off, that whose habitat is still here and can very easily fit back into this ecological niche. Let's bring them back. Let's help the ones now that are going away. And then maybe we can go and do more ancient stuff if we want to.
We're talking about terraforming Mars. Well, you know, why don't we just protect what we have here?
Yes, let's terraform Earth into a more healthier state first. And before, you know, let's practice here, you know, where we live.
The other problem is, alternative energy, windmills, or solar power and everything. We just accept those without looking at it. You know, people say, how come you don't have an electric car? I said, because it's not the answer. 75% of all the energy that propels electric cars comes from coal or oil or nuclear or whatever. You know, you got to plug it in. You forget where that stuff comes from when you plug it in. Plus all the lithium and the cobalt and all the rare metals that are being used to make the batteries and everything. It's not really, I guess it's a bright green solution. It's a very attractive, but it isn't really a solution when you look under the hood, really.
It's a little bit greenwashing.
Yeah. Like, for instance, you know, I find myself opposing offshore windmills. Why? Because the incredible decibel levels that are caused by the construction of these things are killing marine animals. The constant hum, electronic hum through the cables is also affecting marine mammals. It's also affecting the migration of seabirds, and we've done
I'd never considered that, but that makes perfect sense.
we just had studies that we brought scientists out off the coast of France to study the change in the migratory behavior of seabirds because of the windmills on that. So it all sounds on the surface to be a great idea, but we're not taking into account of how destructive it is. And in fact, what they're doing with these offshore windmills is putting them into marine reserves, protected areas, by saying, well, this is a nice area because it's not going to have an impact on, I guess, on people, but it's certainly going to have an impact on other species.
Right. It's the idea, no, we are doing something to save the Earth, but again, it comes back to this anthropocentric view. Yes, you're saving the Earth for yourself. You're not thinking about everybody else who lives here, that who we live alongside of.
And when people say to me, well, you know, you're quite a pessimist, I said, I'm not a pessimist at all, because here's one thing I know for a fact is that no matter what we do, we can't destroy life on this planet. We cannot destroy this planet. 100 million years from now, this is going to be very much a living planet. We're just not going to be here, but we're going to have a serious impact on it, and we're going to cause a lot of extinctions. But this planet is not that easily, life on this planet is not that easily extinguished. But what we have to do is everything we can to save all of those species that we're dragging down like the sinking Titanic, and, you know, we're taking them all with us.
Captain Paul Watson, this has been an absolutely incredible conversation. I've loved this interview. Thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything last minute that you would like to plug? Where can people find you? Where would you like to direct people, our viewers or listeners? Because I'm sure people are very much going to want to get involved and want to know more.
Well, Captain Paul Watson Foundation, we have our website. It's on social networks. We're also our operating name of Neptune's Pirates, because we're going to do a TV show with that name, just like we did Whale Wars, but this is going to be Neptune's Pirates. And what we're really encouraging is people to become monthly donors to the foundation. It doesn't cost much, you know, price of a latte, I guess, every month. If you have a lot of monthly donors, then you have the stability and the security in order to, like, do what we do, which is operate a navy to protect the ocean. So we have three vessels that we have to operate, and they're doing direct intervention to protect life in the sea.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been absolutely incredible. Happy to have you, and I hope we can have you again in the future. Maybe after the operations, Ice Storm and Bloody Fjords have taken place, and maybe we can review and revisit on how maybe they've gone. That would be lovely.
Wonderful. Okay, well, thank you.
You take care.
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in to Pause and Reflect, a podcast made possible by RALDA, the Romanian League in Defense of Animals. Today's conversation reminds us of the power of empathy, the importance of stewardship, and the ripple effect of individual actions towards collective change. If today's story inspired you, please share this episode and help spread the message of hope and action. Every little bit counts. I'm Alexander Taylor Clayton, reminding you to reflect on the role you play in this intricate web of life. Until next time, keep positive and carry the spirit of compassion and curiosity wherever you go.